Greg Wyshynski, something's been bugging me for a while.
Is it an itch down there?
No, it's not an itch. Nothing good. Like that. Nothing. Everything health-wise checks out. Everything's fully functioning. Everything works. Nothing's falling off. Even at my advanced age, Greg Wyshynski, things seem to still be working.
Yeah, but your hair was so boyish on the trade deadline show. I don't know what you mean by advanced
age. The Gatsby?
Age.
You didn't like the Gatsby?
I love the Gatsby.
Thanks, bud.
It's amazing.
Deb Berman special. Well, here's my question. And I really started to think about this when we saw TJ Oshie and his shootout heroics in the Olympics, where a new American star was born.
Yay.
Okay, so the shootout is essentially an extension of the penalty shot. Now, I don't want to talk to you about the shootout because we've been down that road before, but I do want to talk to you about the penalty shot.
Okay.
Now, let me sort of lead the witness here. What is the goal of the penalty shot? Why are penalty shots awarded in the first place?
Penalty shots are awarded in the first place because a scoring chance,
yes,
that percentage-wise should probably have resulted in a goal. An unabated attempt at the goaltender, mm-hmm, was stolen,
right,
from an offensive player by a defender.
And normally, let's face it, it's when a guy's on a breakaway and he gets hauled down.
Well, okay, that's the shorthand of it.
Right. But you're right. It's supposed to recreate a scoring chance.
Yeah.
Now, my problem with it is this. If it's recreating a scoring chance, if you go back to the original chance itself, if that player scores a goal, what comes along with that goal?
A celebration.
And one, maybe two assists.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
If you're taking a penalty shot and you score on the penalty shot, shouldn't you give those guys the assists?
Who gets the assist on a penalty shot? The last two people to touch a puck?
If you go back to the original chance, okay, but when the penalty was called,
uh-huh,
the player gets hauled down. If he hadn't got hauled down and he scored a goal, it would be a goal and there'd be a couple of assists along with it, right?
Right.
But instead, that chance is snuffed out. So you recreate the scoring chance. Shouldn't you attach the assists along with that penalty shot if he scores?
I kind of understand what you're saying because essentially the penalty shot has to be set up, right? There is a play that results in a penalty shot.
No, that results in the original play that leads to the penalty
shot.
Well,
that's what I'm saying. We're saying the same thing. So essentially you should give credit to the players that put that other player in position to receive the penalty.
That's what I'm saying.
In a penalty shot.
That's what I'm saying. Are we not at a place now where we should? I'm going to figure out someone to talk to at the NHL about this. And maybe this will be my big plank as we enter a 12-year agreement with the NHL. Should we not as goofy as this sounds, I think philosophically it makes sense. As goofy as this may sound, should we not award assists on penalty shots?
You're such a hockey dweeb that I guarantee you, like, if you got an audience with the NHL through this Sportsnet deal, like, there is about 10,000 things that I'd like to lay on Gary Bettman's desk besides the carcasses of dead animals to if I was given an audience with him in that way. You would walk in and be like, well, I know that we only have limited time, sir, but I was wondering about the assists on a penalty shot attempt.
Now listen to me. Coley, Gary, Bill,
hear me out.
John,
hear me out.
Let's give me a couple of minutes here. Let me explain this.
That's why he should have gotten the secondary assist on that penalty
shot. You know
that's
all
I'm saying.
You know who would be for it? Agents. True. Agents.
Of course.
Because it's a pad the stats moment for the clients.
Speaking of padding the stats, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to bring this up eventually on the show too.
What's up?
I believe, and I'm sure the people out there will correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that it was the great Jaromir Jagr who just the other day opined about statistics. And why is it that we differentiate between postseason stats and regular season stats? Why don't we tabulate them all into one big category? Maybe not when it comes to awards, maybe not when it comes to season leaders, mm-hmm, but when it comes to career statistics, why don't we value postseason stats as much as we value regular season stats? Why don't we, in the grand big board total of goal scoring or point scoring, incorporate postseason stats into those tallies?
I like the idea of separating it because a lot of teams drop off for once. You're not playing against the entire field. And I kind of put more value on playoff points than I do regular season points. Don't you?
You do. Oh,
yeah,
that's
totally.
Okay.
I always have. Yeah, for sure I always have.
I guess Jagr's point is that as much as we want to say that some players are born with a silver spoon in their mouths and other players are drafted by the Oilers, There is something to be said for performing on the big stage. It's not simply just getting into the playoffs for these guys, a guy like Jágr or whomever. It's scoring goals. It's putting up points. It's actually
it's a Claude Lemieux. It's a Claude Lemieux argument.
Right. So, I mean, from that aspect, I mean, I understand what the counter-argument is perfectly, which is that some guys are going to be able to get a multitude of postseason games while other guys will have, you know, four in their entire career if they played for the Atlanta Thrashers in the 2000s. So I get that argument, but there is some, I kind of agree with Jágr that, like, a goal is a goal. And if we're talking about the immortal players in the NHL, a lot of them are guys that definitely spent a good portion of their career in the postseason, mm-hmm. year after year,
mm-hmm.
Just by virtue of being good and playing with other good players, and it's just kind of the natural progression of things. Why not, when we start comparing the Marios and the Jágrs and the Gretzkys and all these cats, why not incorporate the totality of their offensive output?
Okay, while we're on this, one of the little pet peeves. Oh, by the way, we go back to the original point about assists on penalty shots. Our friends at Kings of Hollywood, or Hockeywood, rather.
Yeah.
Would you also give pluses and minuses to the players who were on the ice when the penalty shot was awarded? Another great quote. I got to add all this up for my big moment with the NHL next year. This is great stuff. But okay, while we're at it then, while we're continuing to sort of, you know, spitball ideas.
Hold on. Before you do that, yeah. I would argue that the only minus in the play should be the offending party on the penalty. Really rub his nose in it.
Oh, everybody else is a watch.
Everyone
is a dash?
Else is even, and he gets the dash.
Oh, wow! Is that like when your dog pees on the floor, and you're like, "All right, get your face in there."
That's right.
Okay. How about this one then?
Uh-huh.
How about?
Oh shit! I broke your train of thought.
No, not at all. I'm just trying to think of how to phrase this properly.
Okay.
Goaltenders, when you look at goalie stats lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wins and losses really mean a lot.
Well, they do, yeah.
Sure. Why don't we assign wins and losses career-wise to players? I mean, how many times do we hear that guy's a winner? Really? How many wins has he been part of versus losses on his team?
Well,
why don't players carry wins and losses like goaltenders do? I understand, the goalie plays the full game, but still,
right.
It is still a team game, yet it's only the goaltender that absorbs the W or the L at the end of it.
I'm generally curious about that, actually, because there are times Yahoo Stats for the NHL have a thing called split stats, and they have a stat, I believe, or you can work the math on it, for what the team's record is when the player is in the lineup or out of the lineup, just so you can sort of figure out road
right.
record, home record, record against a certain team, that kind of thing. And I do find that, and you hear these numbers occasionally when guys are injured and then come back to the lineup, you know, what is their record with this guy in the lineup and what is their record without the guy in the lineup? And, you know, obviously there's some coincidence involved. There are other mitigating factors, but it is kind of an interesting number when you hear it if a team is, I remember when Sean Avery one year for the Rangers, when he was in the lineup, their record was something ridiculously good. And when he wasn't in the lineup, thanks to Tortorella, their record was something ridiculously bad. Like, that kind of thing to me isn't necessarily a canary in the coal mine. There's a lot of other mitigating factors, but it is sort of a point of interest how good a team is when one player is in versus one player being out.
How do you feel about goals that are just jammed in at the goal line? 6-inch goals. Go to the front of the net and start poking at it. Jam.
I think 6 inches is about average, sir. From the materials I've read.
All right, very good. How about this idea?
Which makes Dave Andrechuk an average player.
It's Tim Kerr as well. Phil Esposito to Mini. How about this then? Oh, and this is completely ripped off from the three-point shot in basketball. Awarding a different value for goals scored at certain distances. I.e. a goal in the crease you just poke in is counts for 1 point during a game. A shot from the point, though, is a goal that counts for essentially two goals.
Are you saying that we create scoring zones?
Yes.
Okay. I'll go you one better then.
All right.
If you then score a goal from your defensive blue line. From your defensive blue line. Over the red line, over the other blue line, past the gimpy wickets of a goalie that can't handle the bounce.
Yeah.
What does that count for?
Yeah, exactly. Three goals.
That's
where you get like guys like JC Tremblay back in the league. Right? Get the guys who can flip the puck from their own zone. Drew Doughty's a master of it.
I love that idea because essentially Jonathan Quick's goals against average in the other two zones would be like 0.89. But when you factor in the three-goal right. that he gives up once every 2 weeks.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, that's good.
All right.
Okay, so we've redone hockey now.
We have redone hockey. We have revolutionized the game. Please send us all of your monies for these ideas. Yeah. Kevin Dineen, the gold medal winning coach of the gold medal winning Canadian women's hockey team, will be joining us in the show today, which of course means lots of Whalers talk. And really, what better talk is there? Also, the triumphant return after months on the back burner and some days in which we didn't do it on Friday, the return of Game Show Friday. And folks, if you've been burying your face in trade deadline coverage and still have a bit of an Olympic hangover, this is an essential Game Show Friday for you because it is essentially a current events quiz in the National Hockey League. Also, Kovalchuk settlement, also Canucks looking like a tire fire inside a dumpster fire inside a volcano.
That's bad.
And lots of other stuff. And so with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Porn's always a guinea pig, and porn is always at the vanguard of all new technology. Why didn't that industry get a check from Obama? Two big garbage bags full of Playboy and Penthouse magazines.
Whoa.
Yeah. Nice. 70s style, bro.
Bush! And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
The rise and fall of porn, pun intended. All the girls were like dressed as gangsters or something. It was like a special edition or something.
Debate hockey.
Yes.
The rare ones were he's. Oh, yeah.
And they didn't care. I just want your money.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Oh, man. Facial.com.
Matt Brown celebrating International Women's Day with the intro today.
Yeah. Well done. Bravo, Matty. Take a bow.
Thank you, Matty. Thank you for successfully alienating a good portion of our audience. We try occasionally to do so, but Matty really put his heart and soul into it today.
He's single, ladies, just so you know. What's your Twitter handle there, Matty, if anyone wants to reach out and get in touch with any single females in the crowd? Matty?
I believe it's Jeff Mayer.
Yeah.
At Jeff Mayer. Is that good. Is that it, I think?
Yeah, at good. Sensitive Soul Heart Candies and Flowers at Rogers.net. Jeff Merrick, I will give you some messages from the listeners.
All right, what's up?
Fubar, fubar, fubar. Ha ha, snort. Giant shit show. Millionaires gone broke. Worse than Buffalo. Mike Gillis fired. What do all of these things have in common? They're answers to the question of the day. Describe the current state of the Vancouver Canucks in three words. And those are just some of the 100 or so entries we've received so far. Wow.
You know what's making it worse?
Bieksa called it rock bottom last night. He might be right. That game against Dallas last night was like watching Tyler Seguin go through a turnstile offensively.
Yeah. And he did. Although I still, they're still within striking distance of a play. This isn't rock bottom yet. You want to know what rock bottom is? Go talk to Tim Murray's squad. This is not rock. It feels bad. Is probably what Kevin Bieksa should have said. This isn't rock bottom. Do you think this is rock bottom for Vancouver? Like, there was a moment yesterday, so I'm watching the game, and it's late, and they're getting pumped. And there's a shot of Tortorella on the bench, and he's up and down the bench, and he's yelling at guys and talking to guys and all that. And right in front of him, as if he's looking through the arena, like the thousand-yard stare, there's Ryan Kessler, just oblivious to everything. And he's Ned Braden. He doesn't want to hear what Reg is selling. He wants no part of this.
Well,
he kind of
looks like that half the time, doesn't he?
It was hilarious, though, because everyone's like, looking at torts or moving around. He's a statue. He's a statue on the bench. Just like, this is my job. I'm obligated to do this. I'll go out and do it. I just want to get out of here.
Allie writes in, rattled, no confidence. Andrew Forward writes in, what a state. Like we used to say in NL. DTM about Hart, Bob Hartley won. Yeah, what happened to that whole thing firing up the Vancouver?
You know how many games they've won since then? Can I tell you?
How many?
Three.
Chuck writes in, Torta and Rella. I mean, it's I was on Vancouver radio this morning, on Pratt's show, and I have to admit that I can't remember the last time it went so badly on the ice, and then off the ice, there's no net, there's no contingency plan, there's no plan or future or don't worry about it, things will get sunnier. I mean, it's as if every single thing about the franchise has been dumped into a toilet at the same time.
Yeah. When you do the audit, we've talked about this before, there are no players between the ages of 20 and 25 that are there to help this team.
How dare you besmirch the good name of Zach Kassian?
I love me some Chris Tanev. I like Frankie Corrado a lot. But there's not – they whiffed on that. On that generation, that era right there, there's 5 years of missing at the draft, and the trades have blown up in their faces. Like if there's any general manager in the NHL that I think could seriously look around everybody that he's surrounded himself with, whether it's amateur scouting, pro scouting, and even Lawrence Gilman doing contracts, and say, you know what, we need to clean house here. It's Mike Gillis.
Yeah, but. But again, where's the first shot fired?
Oh, Mike's the writing is on the wall.
And that's the real issue here is like there's so much finger pointing going on, but you can't fire the owners. And you feel like that's where a lot of this is coming from. This change in philosophy that said we cannot win with the style of hockey we've been playing. So we'll go out and get John Tortorella and we'll change the team. I mean, that's an ownership move, right?
Yes, it's become pretty obvious that the Tortorella hiring was not of Mike Gillis' decision.
It would not surprise me to see the fingerprints of ownership in trying to force out a guy rather than buy him out this summer, as they did with Luongo.
They didn't want to go through the remainder of the schedule. I mean, when the Aquilini started hearing the chants at the Heritage game on Sunday of Lou, that was it. They did not want to go through it again.
But here's something I wanted to bring up, and our friend of the show, Joe Haggerty, brought it up last night. And it's a sensitive subject, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. I think the Vancouver Canucks, from a psychoanalytical standpoint, might be the single most scrutinized thing in hockey besides Alex Ovechkin. Everybody's always trying to get into Ovi's head and figure out why things are or are not happening, right?
Right.
And I think Vancouver's the same way. And last night, Haggerty laid it out there because he's a Bruins homer, and I'll repeat it here. Has there ever been a more psychologically damaging loss in the National Hockey League than Vancouver losing in 7 to Boston? Now, you could on the micro level, it's Lucic running over Miller, and then all of a sudden the Sabres kind of change their direction, and they bring on more muscle, and they try to get tougher and be something they're not. Vancouver loses to Boston, and that sets a lot of wheels in motion. The Luongo wheels, because he couldn't win on the road in that series. The toughness wheels, our kung fu versus their kung fu wheels. All of it was kind of set in motion by that loss.
Yeah. Yep, it was. You know, Brad Marchand popping Sedin in the face countless times. Tim Thomas popping Henrik Sedin in the crease.
And Luongo being unable to win on the road.
The Luongo-Thomas dynamic, the pumping the tires, the riots. Yeah. Yep.
Now, here's the thing, and it needs to be said because Tortorella said it last night, and I'll repeat it. They're not out of it yet. Are we saying these things now because they are on a titanic losing streak? Will we still be saying these things in 3 weeks?
Did you see the way they played yesterday?
No, I did.
Did you see the the goal? And here's even Eddie Lack afterwards. I mean, there's one thing to be the backup goaltender. It's one thing to be, you know, the big hotshot prospect in the American Hockey League as well. It's another thing to be the number one. There's a different pressure day to day that comes along with that.
Oh, but it's listen, it's immense. He was literally groomed for about 6 or 7 minutes for that job before they traded Luongo. So, I mean, obviously he's ready to take it over.
I know. And, you know, by the way, you know what really is salt on the open wound? And I'm not sure if I'm the Florida Panthers how much I like this, but nonetheless, the Luongo tweets last night.
I know, yeah.
I'm like, oh, man, you're just jamming it in deep, like the pray for Lack and I could have come up and mopped up this one really nicely. It's just sticking it in.
No, it really is.
Sticking it in. I've never seen. Privately, absolutely. I mean, how many hockey players have you talked to that are like, yeah, man, they lost. It was the happiest day in my life. I was glad to see them get bounced in the playoffs in four. But you never see it publicly. But in a not so subtle way, even though it was, you know, sort of couched in humor, that was Roberto Luongo sticking it to his old team.
Well, absolutely, and that's why Lou's such a stand-up guy, to run away to a two-reporter market and a team where it doesn't matter if you make or miss the playoffs, you still get your money and no one cares. I mean, it was a real stand-up move by Lou to do that.
Wow.
I mean, come on, honestly, right? Like, let's not pretend here that, you know, he can say he wants to turn him into a cup contender or whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, it matters in Vancouver. It doesn't matter in Florida. It just doesn't. And he's going to a place that is he is taking the gold watch of hockey right now. He's going to Florida. He's going back home to a market he's already played in, to a place where there is zero pressure on him to ever do anything but be competent.
Yeah. I'll be curious. I mean, I don't know who gets the last laugh out of all of this. And maybe it's
Luongo.
Maybe it's Luongo, and if he wants to stick it to Vancouver one more time, he retires before the contract is up, and then you know who gets stuck with cap recapture. But I'm really curious to see how Luongo looks behind that Florida defense.
I like, think there, he's going to be a goalie that's going to keep them in.
There are many out there that says there's a question of his mobility. He's not even close to moving the way he used to move.
The East is terrible, and it will remain such. He's going to be able to keep them at least closer to contention than they are, without question.
Well, they're going to be
it's an upgrade.
They're going to be tested by the Sabres tonight, I'll tell you that.
I don't mean now. I mean in the next like 2 or 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, see, it's easy to chuck bombs when you're
from
the comfort of your own couch.
I was happy to see the return of his Pink Panther mask at practice today.
Very much
so. Pink Panther mask, it looks like it'll be back in the NHL. So
absolutely.
For that, it is a happy day.
It is a very happy day. In case you were wondering about Vancouver's tragic number, the number of points gained by the last wild card team or lost by the Vancouver Canucks, sits at 30. Any combination of those two.
Wow.
And the Vancouver Canucks.
We're doing tragic numbers already. Now, janitorial question for you.
Yes, sir.
Kevin Dineen is going to be joining us in about 15 minutes' time. Do you want to do game show now?
Absolutely.
We want to do game show now. So we're going to get our guy or gal. Is it a guy or a gal, Maddie?
It's a guy.
It's a guy?
It's a Virginian, which I didn't know when he was number 7.
All right.
And but he is a Virginian, and he will join us to do our current events quiz. As we're waiting for him last night, obviously Tyler Seguin was the other story in that Vancouver game. Another 5-point game for him this season. A hat trick. A guy threw a cowboy hat on the ice, which was amazing.
Yeah. You see the linesman pick it up too? That was nice touch.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing season for Seguin. And now we get into the territory of how are the Boston Bruins still so good, having traded away both Phil Kessel and Tyler Seguin?
It'll catch up to them.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you continue to, of course, if you're the Red Wings and start finding, picks late in the first round and throughout the draft, you can stave it off. But it's cyclical. It'll catch up to them eventually.
And of course, the other thing we should talk about off of last night's game is an awesome game between the Sharks and the Pittsburgh Penguins last night. The Sharks rally with 3 goals in a row in the third period, 4 goals overall in the third period to beat the Penguins. And Sidney Crosby, as you've seen in the delightful Xbox controller disconnected GIF that's going around, had probably the worst game he's had as a pro. -5, 1 shot on goal, 0 points for Sid last night.
Wow. Pick up on actual hockey talk in a moment, Wish. In the meantime, it's time for you to do your big entertainer's voice here now.
Oh, it's so exciting to do this again here on Friday. Do we have the music or no? Do I just have to do it?
Yeah, we're good to go with the music. Yeah, no, you do the thing, and then Maddie plays the music, and I kind of go, okay, let's go.
All right, it's time for a Friday favorite.
It's Game Show Friday!
Well, that's right. I forgot we put it in the sounder, so I don't have to do it anymore.
What?
I didn't request that, by the way. I'm not a diva. That just sort of started happening.
Hang on. You actually made that a production element?
Yeah, he did.
So you wouldn't have to do it live anymore? Really?
No, I didn't ask for it. That was not me. It just started happening.
No, that was all me. I made him do that.
I should have never pulled the curtain back.
He mails it in some days, so I just want to try a good one.
Oh, you dick.
Lick the envelope, Wyszynski.
Joining us now from Centerville, Virginia, Andy Thornton joins the Merrick vs. Wyszynski podcast. Hello, Andy. How are you?
Hey, Andy.
Andy?
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, there's Andy. Very good. Andy, are you a fan of the Washington Capitals?
No, I'm a fan of the Carolina Hurricanes.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go. So your thoughts on them not doing jack and shit at the deadline this year?
They moved Rue, too. They freed up some space. I want to get front of that contract. Come on.
Yeah, hopefully more will happen in the offseason, but it was a good start, at least, I guess, with Rue 2 going.
If you had to move one of the three goaltenders, who would you move?
Cam.
Oof. So that kind of leads me to the next question, and I think I already know the answer, which is that you kind of think they need to majorly retool this, don't you?
Yeah, when you're going on 5 years in a row without the playoffs, you kind of need to make a retool.
Yeah, I'm worried about our boy Kirk Muller, Merrick.
I know.
Love him.
I know.
I'm getting a little nervous.
Yeah, I don't think he's long for this world at all.
Jesus, Andy, I don't think they're going to kill him.
It's a job. It's a job.
Well, the hockey world.
The hockey world. Gotcha. Very good.
Yeah.
All right, so the game show Friday for you, it's courtesy of Quizmaster Wyszynski. I have compiled for you a current events quiz for the National Hockey League. A lot of us are still going over the trade deadline. A lot of us might still be recovering from Sochi. By a lot of us, I mean me.
Yeah.
This is a current events quiz as to who are the leaders and trailers in the National Hockey League right now. As of today, as of right now, this Friday that we are all living, March 7th, these are the stats up until this point in time. Are you ready to play Game Show Friday? By the way, Andy, a 60% out of 10, 6 out of 10 is what we're looking for here. We demand a D average from you, and are you ready to play?
Sure, let's go.
Okay, here we go. Question number one. This Boston Bruin leads the National Hockey League with 4 shorthanded goals. Name him.
4 shorthanded goals.
Take a stab.
I'd have to think Bergeron.
Ah, no, sir. It is Brad Marchand who tallied a goal last night, an empty netter. 4 shorties for Marchand to lead the National Hockey League.
Did you see his comments in the post-Olympics?
What did he say?
He said, "How is a Team Canada orientation camp in Calgary on the, you know, doing the ball hockey with everybody else?" I'm thinking to myself, "What the hell am I doing here?" That's pretty good.
He's pretty good. Question number two: this Philadelphia Flyers defenseman leads the National Hockey League in block shots. I will freely admit this is kind of a trick question.
Ed Van Imp.
Name this Flyers defenseman who leads the NHL in block shots.
Not Shel Samuelson.
John block shots. For the trick question, I have to think it would be McDonald.
Oh, correct. Nailed it.
Nicely done. 201 block shots for Andrew, former Islander McDonald, and who will, of course, get a contract from the Flyers this summer that is above and beyond what he'll be worth. Question number three. This Vancouver Canuck leads the NHL in major penalties with 15. Name him.
Penalties with 15. Cespedo?
Yep.
Correct, Mundo. Tom Cespedo. He is the leader with 15 major penalties. This goalie leads the National Hockey League in shutouts with 6.
Rask.
That's right. Tuukka Rask. 6 shutouts. Playing behind a decent defensive team, Merrick. They looked okay last night.
Yeah, a little
the
bit.
Capitals.
Yeah,
they looked all right.
Just a little bit.
I was actually getting Canada USA flashbacks in that game, and the Capitals' complete inability to get anything going offensively. I think they had 4 shots on goal maybe in the first period in that game.
How was John Carlson?
It was just, oh, Jesus.
Sorry.
It was just an ass kicking. Question number 5. This is the best offensive team in hockey right now, with a goals per game average of 3.38. Hint, they don't really have a second line center. Name them.
If they don't have a second line center, is the Blackhawks?
Correct, Amundo. The Chicago Blackhawks are your best offensive team in hockey right
Andy's
now.
Andy's good.
Conversely, Andy, this is the worst defensive team in hockey, with a goals against average of 3.32. Hint, their starting goalie was injured this season.
Starting goalie was injured this season.
Worst defensive team in hockey. In 3, 2, 1. Your answer, please.
Oilers.
Islanders. The New York Hockey Islanders, who, of course, lost Evgeny Nabokov earlier this season.
And they were up 2-0 on the Oilers last night.
Goals against average of 3.32. All right, this is going to get a little simple for the next three questions. It's a this or that kind of format. Ready?
Okay.
Who has more points as of March 7th, Claude Giroux or Jamie Benn?
It was Giroux or who?
Giroux or Jamie Benn.
Giroux?
Correct. 64 points for Giroux. Jamie Benn had 59. Better plus minus, meaning, you know, better as in positive. Tyler Myers or Alex Ovechkin?
Ooh. Myers?
Tyler Myers is a minus 22, but Alex Ovechkin is a minus 24. So it is, in fact, Tyler Myers with the better plus minus.
Well done.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sir, you've already got your 6. Now it's just gravy. Now it's just gravy on the sundae right here. Tragic number. Which team is closer to elimination at this point in the season? The Buffalo Sabres or the Edmonton Oilers?
Buffalo Sabres or the Oilers? It has to be Buffalo?
Buffalo is correct. The Buffalo tragic number is 17. Any combination of points gained or points lost. And Edmonton's is 18. So you are correct. You have 7 correct now. You're doing a hell of a job. You know your current events in the National Hockey League. Finally, this team leads the NHL in power play time this season. Which team has the most power play time this season? And since you've already gotten your big victory, no clues.
Yeah.
No clues on this one.
Take that, sucker.
Earn it, Andy.
Power play time, jeez.
Your answer, please.
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh is not the correct answer. The correct answer is the Los Angeles Kings. 397 minutes and 5 seconds in 64 games. I will then point out, Jeff Merrick.
What's that?
That the team with the least amount of power play time this season would be the Boston Bruins, with just 287 minutes and 8 seconds in 62 games, which of course means that Colin Campbell is no longer in the position of power in the National Hockey League.
That's funny.
Well, great job, man. You did it. You killed it. You got 7 right. And there'll be some sort of prize coming your way. Matt will take your information and send something to you. And this is the part where we turn the mic over to you and allow you to plug what you'd like and say hi to who you'd like as well.
I don't have any plugs or likes. I guess I'll just say hi to my wife, Nicole.
Oh, that's sweet.
That's lovely.
Are you on the Twitters?
Probably, yeah. I don't really tweet anything, though.
But do you have a Twitter handle that people can congratulate you on?
Yes, it's B-A-T Andy Thornton.
And can you, your email address, by the way, I will not give the internet provider, but your email address is hockeyzombies.
Yeah, it's two of my favorite things in the world, so you got to represent.
Are you a Walking Dead fan?
Oh, absolutely.
I've been catching up on all the episodes that I missed while I was in Sochi. I'm now 3 deep, and it's been a very emotional journey so far. I'm very happy to be out of the prison, and I'm very happy to be finding some backstory for Michonne, to be honest with you, because I thought that was such a wasted character, and now I actually care about her.
Yeah, it's definitely, I've liked where they're going with it. I've started reading the comic a little bit too, and it's completely different from the show, but yeah, I've liked the way they've been going with it.
It couldn't be more different. Like, the show is approachable for an average citizen, and the comic is for depraved people. It's a depraved,
yeah, the comic
nasty
is very
comic. Oh, my God, right? It's like, I pity people that watch the show and pick up the comic thinking it's going to be like, oh, dreamy shots of Norman Reedus. No, not so much. It doesn't work out that way at all. By the way, we're speaking complete Greek to Merrick right now, so we'll probably stop the zombie conversation.
Yeah, I'm checking out Twitter.
Bid you adieu, Andy, and thanks for playing Game Show Friday, my friend.
Stay on the line, dude.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Andy.
He knows. A strong showing for
Andy. He knows the stuff. He knows what's going on. He knows the time and temp.
That's right. He knows what's up. He knows what's down.
And I love when people tweet us in saying, I would have won that. Kind of like, our good friend Tally DeShane and Katie Brown would have won Game Show Friday, by the way, with Shinsuke and Merrick. So there you go.
Totally. They totally would have. It's current events. As we wait for Kevin Dineen, let's talk a little bit about a major piece of news that came down since the last time we met. Ilya Kovalchuk. And the New Jersey Devils getting a first-round pick back from the NHL, 30th overall in the draft this summer.
I like it.
After getting it taken away from them in the punishment for the rejected contract back in 2010.
See, I like it because I don't think there should have been a punishment in the first place. The punishment should have been, no, sorry, Lou, Central Registry doesn't accept this contract. Why does there have to be punishment along with it? Like, I can understand punishing the New Jersey Devils if they iced a team, for example, against the Flyers or the Penguins or the Islanders that exceeded the salary cap. That I could understand. But you submit a contract that gets rejected. That's your punishment. You don't get the contract.
But isn't it sort of in keeping with that idea that if you attempt to circumvent the salary cap, you're going to get some sort of punishment? Like, the salary cap is sacrosanct. Like, you can't violate the cap. And they're simply just extending from the player personnel thing.
But the problem with this one was it was arbitrary because it had been going on. Hello, Mika Kiprasov. Hello, Marian Hossa. Hello, Henrik Zetterberg. I mean, go through all of them. And it was just like the NHL just said, okay, that's it. Enough. Now we're going to attach penalties. Now we're going to attach penalties to it. But the penalty just should have. But here's the thing. The penalty just should have been, now we're not allowing this to happen. Go back and do the contract again. He's still a free agent.
Your problem with it is also my problem with it, which is that it was complete selective hypocrisy. I mean, if you look at Kovalchuk's contract, it's just Hossa's contract or Luongo's contract on steroids. That's all it is. I mean, when contracts are being structured with minimum wage years at the end that you know are bullshit that are just there to bring down the cap, I mean, it was really deplorable, I thought, for the league to come down on one contract because it cheated a lot versus coming down on other contracts that were clearly also cheating. And that was always my problem with it. But that said, and I was called a fence sitter yesterday for saying this, but let me explain. I think the NHL is wrong to give them back the pick. I really do. Like, stick to your guns. I understand that the Devils are still punished. They lost a third-round pick. Instead of $3 million, they'll pay $1.5 million. Instead of having what could have been a top 10 pick, they'll have to pick 30th. Like, there are penalties that they've received for the Kovalchuk contract. That said, it's pretty obvious that the NHL is reestablishing the Devils' first-round pick as doing a solid to the new owners for taking on some of the most toxic debt
it looks
of
like
any
that.
Team
that's my,
in the league.
Oh, that's, it's, my, that's it, my main
Lamoriello pro- came out. Lamoriello came out and said yesterday, it's our owners that got the pick back. I mean, it couldn't be more clear. That's disgusting. Yeah. That's a terrible precedent.
He said that. Hey, I missed that. Oof. Like, I was going to say, we don't know that that's the truth or not. It just optically, it does look like that.
He said the owners asked for the pick back and the league reconsidered it. And yeah, now granted, there is a new consideration here, which is that Kovalchuk's no longer in the league. But why should that have any bearing on the initial contract?
It shouldn't.
Right, exactly. So even as a Devils fan who's happy that I'll be able to cover the draft this summer and see the team pick in the first round, that's great. It'll help the team. You know, maybe it'll be another Stefan Matteau or another son of a Ranger who used to kill the Devils available down in the lower part of the first round for Lou to pick. But that said, the idea that the NHL would acquiesce on this because somebody decided to take on the debt load of the Prudential Center is just disgusting, isn't it?
It doesn't feel good, but I'm glad that New Jersey got the pick back to begin with because I didn't agree with the punishment in the first place, is my perspective on it.
If if somebody bought the Canucks, right, or the Canucks after the 2005 lockout,
and gave him Schneider back,
they reduced the Bertuzzi penalty to do him a solid. Like, but wait a minute.
I mean, punishments are constantly scaled back. I mean, Rafi Torres had his monster suspension for drilling Marian Hossa scaled back as well. So it's not as if it's unprecedented for the NHL to do this upon further review and upon further reflection.
But usually the further reflection is within a few months. It's not 4 years down the line, which is what this situation is. Where they clearly have
here's the new shit that came to light.
It's not us thinking we overreacted a few months ago and now we're going to come back because now we know what Marian Hossa's health situation is. The new shit that came to light is somebody bought this team and nobody else would, and now we're going to do him a solid for doing so.
You know,
the new shit.
And you have to wonder
bribery.
You wonder
owners bribe the NHL to get the first round pick back.
You have to wonder how much Lou knew somewhere down the road this would happen, because when they had the opportunity to forfeit a 29th overall pick, and they didn't do it. And I know they didn't have a second. They didn't want to pick all the way until the third round. I get that. But didn't it kind of feel weird? Like, what does Lou know that we all don't? And don't forget for one moment how close Lou is with the NHL and how much of an architect he was for that CBA. I mean, he was one of the roll up the sleeves guy for that CBA that helped put all that in place. He did a lot of work for NHL head office.
In all seriousness, though, do you think Lou knew something concrete or had an inkling the way he operated in the last 3 years?
I would have to say had an inkling. Or just thought somewhere. I can't, because I don't know the nature of the conversation. You know, is this one of those, we're going to take away a first-round pick, wink, wink, keep making your picks. I can't prove that. I don't know that.
Uh-huh.
And I can't claim to know the nature of that conversation or that sidebar agreement if it did indeed exist.
I tend to believe inkling, too, but I also tend to believe that Lou knows he's Loophole Lou and knows that things have a funny way of working out for him down the line, you know. And he also was the guy who came out and threw the contract under the bus too. He was clearly in the NHL's corner for most of this,
but yeah, right? Exactly. Well, from day one, I remember the press conference itself. You remember it? Is that one of the weirdest things I've ever seen? Here's Lou Lamoriello presenting his shiny new toy, saying, "I don't like this deal." He said, you know, you can do a Lou Lamoriello voice better. You know, I don't like these contracts. I think these contracts are bad for hockey. Nonetheless, New Jersey Devils fans, here's Ilya Kovalchuk.
Right. So in the last year, Lamoriello has found a way to make Kovalchuk disappear, his contract disappear, so new owners would want to buy the team without a $100 million contract in the books.
Yeah, he's a magician.
Get the cap recaptured down to roughly $250,000 against the cap, which is peanuts, and get the first round pick back. So my only question left is, so when does Parise come back? Is he on the way? Is he on a flight right now? It seems like we've gone back in time and have reversed everything that's happened to the Devils because of Kovalchuk. So when does do we retroactively get the 2012 Cup? I mean, how does it work now? What else do we get?
it's kind of a head scratcher. To me, this is putting right what shouldn't have been done in the first place. That's how I look at it. I can't speak to sidebar agreements. I can't speak to, if you'll pick up this huge debt load, we'll look the other way on the first round pick, because I don't know that. To me, I think this is a good way to put something right that was done wrongly in the first place.
Right. No, I agree.
Because if you have a bad contract, it just doesn't get accepted. Right? I never understood from day one. Why did there have to be punishment attached to it? The punishment is we don't accept the contract. Sorry, he's a free agent.
Well, like I said, I think the extension of the cap penalty is what they thought there. But again, like we both said, it's not as if other teams weren't necessarily going down the same road as they were.
They were just the NHL. I think the NHL was just embarrassed. Because that was a huge win for them, that the CBA coming out of the 205 lockout, that was a huge win for them. And the moment a loophole got exposed, it got torn wide open. And the NHL said, enough's enough. We're really slamming the hammer down here.
I saw this yesterday when Drager first tweeted out the fact that the Devils were getting their pick back. He's like, and a bunch of teams are really upset about the Devils not getting this punishment, or upset that the Devils' contract helped hasten the era of cap recapture. And I'm like, I know exactly who those teams are. They're the ones who got left out of the party because they chose not to attend it.
Yeah, you know? that's not Chicago. That's not Detroit. That's not Calgary.
Chicago, Detroit, the Rangers, Calgary, the Devils, Vancouver. All of these teams decided to try to retain or bring in new talent through cap circumventing contracts. It's not as if it's the Devils alone that got this boulder rolling down the hill. And I'm sorry, Ted Leonsis, who decided to pay Alex Ovechkin in real dollars throughout the entirety of his contract instead of doing what everybody else was doing, what all the cool kids were doing. Sorry it messed with you. But, I mean, if you weren't doing it back then, I don't know what's up. I don't know what you were thinking. Maybe you had the crazy foresight that cap recapture was going to happen in the next CBA. Maybe you knew that was down the pike. But
well, Brian Burke's the big one, right? Because if there's any team that could have used money as a resource to front load contracts to get players, it was Toronto. But Brian Burke stood up by his principles and said it was bad for hockey, even though it would have been great for his team. Uh-huh. He still had, in that situation, more of an affinity towards working for. And remember, he worked on behalf of the NHL against the Kovalchuk contract. You know, I mean, I live here in Toronto. I know there was a lot of people in the city saying, why isn't Brian Burke doing this, front-loading contracts to get significant players? Because he had this ethic about those deals, and he put the good of the league ahead of the good of his team. That soured a lot of people.
Right, and in theory, I mean, you know, some of these transactions might have been happening too close to Secretary's Day or Arbor Day.
Grammar Day.
Winter Solstice. I mean, any of the holidays in which we have a trade freeze for Brian Burke.
You know, on National Woodchuck Day, people pay too much money in these trades, signing these players.
No, completely. Absolutely. As we wait around for Deneen, who I think is going to be joining us in a second or two, last night also saw a game between the Detroit Red Wings and the Colorado Avalanche that was completely secondary to the retirement of number 5, almost number 9, as he told in a story at the event last night, which was hilarious. You hear that story?
Yeah.
He came into the NHL asking for number 9 from the Red Wings.
Well, like, okay, so now here's what you do. After watching him last night, you say to yourself, you're Ken Holland, okay, number 5's up there. Go get number 9 and get Lidstrom back.
Right. he was great. And I loved the entire event. It went on for about 45 minutes, which I'm sure really made Colorado feel good about life. But it was one of the only number retirement ceremonies where it felt like a celebration of a team and an era as much as it was a celebration of a player. Now, a lot of that is Lidstrom himself kind of being selfless, kind of passing the spotlight along to Yzerman and other people in the organization. But it really kind of felt like here we are talking about this era of Red Wings hockey and talking about the primary reason it existed. With all due respect to Yzerman, to Fedorov, to Shanahan, to all of the Chelios, all of the other players that were involved down the line with this team, it's Lidstrom. It's built on the back of Nick Lidstrom. No one else had Nick Lidstrom, and every single year they had a chance to win the cup because he played on that team.
And I don't have to go really look back in the history of hockey, but I don't know that I can think of off the top of my head someone who retired while still playing at as an elite a level as Nick Lidstrom was doing. Like, he's a Norris Trophy finalist, and he retired. Right? There's still plenty of years left for Nicklas Lidstrom, but he retired.
Yep.
And he walked away. You know, one of the smartest things that the Detroit Red Wings organization did, and this was Brian Murray, got to give full props to him. The first thing they did was when he came in as a fresh-faced rookie, remember who they paired him up with? Brad McCrimmon.
Oh yeah,
they put him with Beast, and you know, as you transition from the bigger ice in Europe to the smaller, you know, a little more dangerous and physical a game, they put him with the perfect defender, And by the end, it was more Lidstrom helping McCrimmon than it was McCrimmon, God rest his soul, than McCrimmon helping Lidstrom. But I thought that was a masterstroke from Brian Murray, putting him with Brad McCrimmon.
It was a hell of a thing last night to watch Lidstrom and see the celebration and hear the fans chanting out and screaming out, you know, come back one more year or whatever, for obvious reasons. They could use him. But it was such a selfless thing. It was a real logo on the front kind of thing, although he did reference the name on the back when talking about his family, which was a classy move. And I don't know if we'll ever see it again. I don't know if we'll ever see one player dominate his position like that. Maybe a goalie. I mean, we might see a goalie again come down the pike and do what Hasek did or do what Brodeur did and have a run where the Vezina is automatic for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess that would depend on the system of hockey that they play. But I don't know if we'll see another defenseman. I don't know if we'll see another
defenseman
why? That has a run like Lidstrom had.
You know why? Because he played with such a high skill and I don't want to say a soft touch because I don't think of Nick Lidstrom as a soft player. But he was one of the smartest players we ever saw. And here's a guy that would compete for Norris trophies and Stanley Cups every year. And you look at his stat line at the end of the year, and you scramble to find double digits for hits. Like, when you look at, like if you're showing tape to young hockey players, like 8, 9, 10 years old, and when kids are starting to learn how to body check and hitting, and it's a pretty controversial topic for young hockey players, you just show them Nick Lidstrom of how you can play the game and not necessarily have to make bone-crunching body checks, or, and this is maybe even more importantly, how not to get hit. Like, when there's, like, normally defensemen are always getting rocked, right? Because that's dangerous when you're going and fetching pucks in the corner.
Right.
When did you ever see him get caught?
Never.
And when did you ever see him hammer someone?
Never.
Right. So what made Nick Lidstrom so good? He had this sense of knowing where everybody was and what everybody was doing and how to protect himself. One of the things that's really underrated about Nick Lidstrom, he knew how to protect, he knew how to keep his head up, he knew who was coming, he knew how to put his body in position that he didn't get destroyed out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a, I mean, sure, everyone gets nicks and cuts and you know, we know what happened that way, he had to put on the visor and everything, but I mean, he came out of it basically, considering how long he played, how many minutes, at such a high level. He got out almost perfectly healthy, all things considered. Like, he is the smartest hockey player that generation saw,
and
hands down.
And one of the only guys that I ever remember watching, even more so than Bork, even more so than Stevens, even in some cases more so than Niedermeyer, where if you were lucky enough to get a two-on-one the other way, and he was the guy back, you knew it didn't matter.
Yeah.
He would find a way to break it up, whether he was going to break up the pass, whether he was going to poke check the shooter. It was amazing to watch him do that and just be confident that it didn't matter. You were not going to victimize Nick Lidstrom.
Anybody walk the line better? The offensive blue line on a power play?
Oh, it was gorgeous.
No one. See, the thing about Lidstrom, too, is he just did it and he made it look so damn easy. Like, hockey just looked, that's the thing about great hockey players.
Yeah.
They just make it look so simple. Like,
effortless.
You look at like an elite level player like Patrick Kane. He still does things and you go like, holy smokes, that's incredible. Man, that looks really hard to do. Like, when he starts stick handling and tight and all that, you go, wow, that's incredible. And it looks really hard to do. Did you ever watch a Nick Lidstrom game and go, man, that looks tough to do? He's
well,
like,
it's
no,
that,
it doesn't.
It's that extra level of, like, there's some guys that seem like they're making magic happen because they're hustling to do it, and Kane's a perfect example. Like, every time you see Patrick Kane do something magical with the puck, it's not as if you're sitting back and saying, wow, that's God-given ability. It's like, wow, he really hauled ass down the wing and made something happen, and look how hard he's working. Mario was like Lidstrom. Mario was a guy who I think in some cases people tagged as being lazy because it was so effortless. Because he didn't need to haul ass down ice, and it just came so naturally, and it was just all in the hands sometimes for Mario.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys just do it, and you're right. Like it's like, when are you breaking a sweat, dude?
Do you remember the defenseman he came over with? Because two defensemen came over from Sweden for Detroit. Do you remember who the other one was? It's one of our favorite names.
Go ahead.
Pear Juice.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir. The two big rookie defensemen Detroit was bringing in. Pear Juice and some guy by the name of Nick Lidstrom, third-round pick for the Detroit Red Wings. Things worked out a little bit differently for Pierre Juice.
Given hope to all the third round picks.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Hang on. Our guest is standing by. He is a gold medal coach. He is a former NHLer. As a player, former NHLer, as a head coach as well, and will certainly be one again, no doubt. Joining us on the line with a gold medal for Team Canada, he is Kevin Dineen. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, I thought you'd have a little like whaler overload. I was not expecting a return invite this quickly, so thanks for having me on, boys.
If it'll make you feel any better, Kev, we can play Brass Bonanza in the background and throw it right back at you as a Hartford Whaler. One sort of hockey geeky question to start things off. We'll go to the women's tournament and we'll go a little bit back on your career as well. Leading into the Olympics, USA had dined out against Team Canada. And one of the things that they had done so successfully with all the left-hand shots on the Canadian blue line, they were just dumping it in the right side and flooding it. And that was it. That's where the puck would turn over and USA was off to the races. How did you combat that in the two games you played against the States?
Well, we always you're asking Jeff about them dumping it into our right corners.
Yeah.
You know what we did is we just had our centermen come back and just get really low and literally stop in front of the net because they were coming hard with one and their second player wasn't even like they were going directly to the defenseman, so the defenseman would the other defenseman. So it was like two players coming right on strong, and then third player was coming up the wall. So the middle of the ice just seemed to be always open. So we just felt like all we had to do was have our centermen just come down. And you're always trying to catch, you know, you put little names on things, and we just called it low and slow for our centermen. And that's, you know, plagiarized from somebody else somewhere down the line. I don't even know where. But you know what? If that center's low and slow, it just made it really easy for a left-handed defenseman to kind of pull it towards our net. And then just pop it to that centerman right there. And then we were off to the races and had pretty good success on our breakout.
Greg, go ahead.
When I saw you in Sochi, sir, and again, congratulations on the gold, I asked you the difference between an NHL celebratory locker room and a women's gold medal celebratory locker room. I wanted to ask you another comparison question. What is the level of chirping like in a women's gold medal game between the U.S. and Canada versus the chirping that you might get in, say, a Stanley Cup playoff game?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, here's where you get into those conversations that you would probably say one thing off air and one thing on air. All I will say is I am extremely, extremely impressed with the composure of our players. And you know what? There was a lot of talk before about how, you know, we were playing an opponent that was more skilled and faster and prettier, and I don't know all those different things. And our players, you know what? They just played the game. But I was extremely surprised with the amount of chit chat that was going on as that game wound down, especially when we were down two goals, and you know. Gets back to that karma thing. It comes back, and somewhere along the line, you go out and you do your business, and you do it in the right way. And it's amazing that things tend to work out. And a very fortunate win for us, but well earned.
Now, when you say surprised, do you mean impressed with the level of artistry?
No, that's it. It was no creativity. You know, it was just really, really nasty and almost in the gutter. And that's, you know, it's easy to say that stuff now. But, it was not a whole lot of difference between the boys and the girls in that case.
It's one of those games, you know, and Kevin, you and I were talking about this in the strategy room a couple of days ago at Deadline. You know, it's one of those games for Canadian hockey fans where it's going to turn into one of those where were you stories. You know, where were you when Marie-Philippe Poulin scored that goal? I mean, I'm sure you've talked to countless people who have maybe, you know, not that you've asked, but they just come up. And how many people have just come up to you, Kevin, and said, let me tell you where I was when this happened? Yeah. Like, they feel compelled to tell you the story.
It really is, and I guess that's the best example of the level of interest, enthusiasm there was for that game. That doesn't matter if I'm speaking to a relative or a stranger walking through Pearson Airport in Toronto. It was all over. Even today at the golf tournament, I think Quebec is well represented down here in the Miami area this time of year. So there was. Lots of excited Canadians around, and everybody just, you know what, they just it was one of those games that as enthusiastic and as dominant as the men's game was, I think ours was a little more memorable just by the way it played out and the emotion that went into that game and the pride that people got into Canadian hockey afterwards. So looks good on Hockey Canada and a great moment for our nation.
Let me follow up if I can quickly on 29, Marie-Philippe Poulin. I was telling you this story that at orientation camp in 2009, I was standing there watching the women skate before the guys, and Vinny LeCavalier came over and said, "Who's number 29?" I said, "It's the teenager, Marie-Philippe Poulin. You know, she's just a kid, but, you know, high expectations for her." And he watched her for about 5 or 10 minutes, and he looked at me and said, "Now, that is a hockey player. She's going to be fantastic one day." Can you tell us a little bit, from a coach's point of view, what is it about Marie-Philippe Poulin? I mean, she was a star in Vancouver. She was a star again in Sochi. She's, you know, becoming, if not already there, the face of Canadian women's hockey once Haley Wickenheiser hangs it up. Tell us a little bit about Marie-Philippe Poulin.
Well, and a well-deserved title, and I don't think Vinny's going to have to become a scout after he's done playing. I think he'll be all right, but he's got a pretty good eye for the game. She can do it all. You know what? She takes real pride in winning face-offs. She takes pride in matching it up. I mean, I had the last change. I matched her up against Kessel's line, their most skilled line, and I did that for a reason because I felt like they were the ones that could match up with their speed, but also could help shut them down. And I felt that was one of our most effective things, was shutting down Amanda Kessel. I don't think she got used a heck of a lot in the Olympics, but, you know, she's a really dynamic player. So that was a good matchup for us. You know, Marie-Philippe is just, she's the kind of player that, the best example was a conversation I had. It was, we had talked about shifts being too long, and sure enough, we're out on a 5-on-3. And right in the middle of the 5-on-3, we have full possession of the puck. It was about 35, 40 seconds into it. And there she goes skating as hard as she can to our bench. And we hop on, a new player comes out, gets right involved in the player. And it was, I probably showed it to our team as an example, probably two different times in video, of what it means to be a team, because you know what? You never see that. You don't ever see, because it's always skilled players out there on a 5-on-3. They want to be out there. They're out there for a reason. You've got full possession of the puck, but she's all about the team and she's all about the game. And you know what? She's an incredibly special player and person.
Awesome. And then speaking of another incredible player, some news about your goaltender today. Shannon Zabido is going to sign with the, or has signed with the Columbus Cottonmouths of the Southern Professional Hockey League. What do you think about that?
Well, I had a good chat with Shanny there yesterday, and she was had concerns about Hockey Canada's reaction. And I had a good talk with Scott Smith after that, and really encouraged her to go out and explore that opportunity. I think she's going to be just fine in that environment. I think she's has the ability to be a very strong player for that team. And I don't think this is one of those gimmicky things that we're doing that to try to draw people and the fans. Although I think I'd be naive to say that wasn't on the owner's mind or whoever it is to a certain extent. But she can play. She's got the game for it. And I'm really looking forward to her. I told her to text me when her first start is and try to catch it on the internet. And I'm just thrilled for her. I think it's a great opportunity. I think it's a great thing for women's hockey as well. And you know, she'll be more than up to the task.
You know, such a great rivalry, Canada versus the United States, both the men's and certainly the women's level specifically. I can recall Haley Wickenheiser in one of her interviews saying, you know, the nature of the, you know, the hockey hate between these two teams. She said, "I really wish there was fighting allowed in women's hockey." Kevin, should there be fighting allowed in women's hockey?
No, well, maybe once or twice. Every now and then. I tell you what, when my first game there, I was like, "Are you kidding me?"
Get a line brawl, Kevin.
And I was like, "This is not going to happen again on my watch." I was like, "Girls, this is the end of this." And I started calling them players and ladies and women, but now I just call them girls since we won the gold. I can call them that. So, You know what? I was kind of like, this is just, I don't think it's good for it. But in all honesty, sometimes there's a player on the other team that needs a good pounding. They need to answer the bell of, you know, you got to answer to your actions. And it's no different than a lot. It's no different than the U.S. college game. You get somebody running around acting like there's no repercussions to their actions, and they're able to play a very strong game in that rat type role. But if you could put a stop to that just once or twice, it would certainly even the ledger. But I don't think it's going to happen, nor do I. I think that's just emotion talk, and I don't think it makes a lot of common sense.
There you go. Just overall, your Olympic experience. I mean, what did you think of Sochi?
I can't say enough about it. I mean, my first day there, I was out riding a bicycle around town. Canadian Olympic Committee had about 60 bikes for all the athletes and staff in the village. And I ran into a reporter who asked for an interview. And you know what? Every question they asked was framed. It was framed to see if they could get a negative response. And I had absolutely, not only did I have nothing bad to say about it, I mean, it was just an incredible experience. I couldn't wait for my family to get over there and enjoy it with us. And, it was a really, obviously not even without the ending and the dramatic finish with the gold medal game, but it was a, incredibly well run and, weather was great, facilities, the food, you know, just can't say enough about it. So it was, that was all great, but that's just stuff. What really made the difference was the people. And, again, the Olympic team in general, and that's not just hockey. I think to an athlete, you see the comments coming out of, the Olympics. That's where the enjoyment was, where the speed skaters were, enjoying the hockey players and the hockey players were enjoying hanging out with skiers and, all over the place. And, a large cheering section for everybody as well. And, made for a special, couple weeks.
Kevin, before we let you go, you have to indulge me with two questions. One is about your father and the other is about the Hartford Whalers. First with the Hartford Whalers, you scored, the last goal in Whalers franchise history. Do you still have the puck?
Oh boy, yes, yeah. That one's sitting in my basement up at our lake house. So I do have that one for sure.
The other one about your father and coaching in the WHA, and I was texting back and forth with Scott Campbell, who played for your father in Houston, with the Arrows, and says, "Hey, if you have Kevin on, tell him you know, his dad was one of the best coaches, if not the best coach I ever had." How much did your dad tell you about the WHA?
Oh, that's great. Well, he didn't have to tell me much because I lived the WHA. I mean, I was there from the ground floor you know, it was funny. I was telling Bob Nicholson that, you know, my dad coached Bob Nicholson in Penticton. We were actually supposed to move out there to British Columbia, and he was going to take over that team. And then the next thing you know, the WHA started. And we were there from the ground floor. So, you know, I think Scott Campbell would be the first one that I'd heard the nickname Soupy, and certainly not the last guy with the name Campbell that had that nickname. So, you know, those are the kind of guys that were just so special. And, you know, Rich Preston, I got a hello with him when I was out in Calgary for a short stint. And Terry Ruskowski, our paths have crossed. I had a great a note from Larry Lund, who lives in Penticton, was a great sentiment for my dad. So, you know, Gordy, obviously Mark and Marty were a huge part of that franchise. So, you know, for me, that's where my bones are. Somebody asked me today what team I grew up cheering for, and it was kind of funny, NHL team. And it wasn't Detroit that my dad had played for. It was, you know, the Houston Arrows or the Hartford Whalers or, you know, some of those great old jerseys that were in the WHA. Great time, great thing to be a part of.
Amen to that. Hey, Kevin, you got one more?
Last one.
Sure,
one
go
last
ahead.
One. Kevin, did you ever get sick of Brass Bonanza? You can tell us.
No, I still, you know what, I don't have it as a ringtone or anything like that, but you know what, I married a Hartford girl. I got, I think after you retire, you might have been to a few different cities, but there's somewhere that you're always identified with, and I don't think it's one of those franchises. People don't have too many bad things to say about it. It was a great place to play, and For me, that's just part of the package, along with that. My kid wore a Whaler T-shirt to school today, so I don't know where it's dragged out of the closet. So, you know, it still lives. I gotta hang with the brass bonanza.
That's father awesome. Of the year material, letting your kid wear a mighty whale shirt to school.
Indeed. Kevin, thanks so much. Great job, trade deadline with us at Sportsnet as well. Continued success wherever you end up next.
Thanks, Jeff. Really, I enjoyed that. That was a really, I wanted to tell Theo, said that he was surprised at how slow it was, and I wanted to jump right on him and say, slow, this was unbelievable. It was a lot of action, but I was a little scared of him, so I didn't say that aloud. So.
It beats working for a living, eh, Kevin?
It sure does. It's good stuff.
All right, we'll keep in touch. Talk soon.
Talk to you online.
Kevin Dineen, gold medal winning coach, Team Canada, women's side of things, former NHLer, former Hartford Whaler, Brass Bonanza lover. You know who it was who eliminated the Brass Bonanza, right, Greg?
Who was that? It was, I'm guessing, Howard Baldwin?
It was Brian Burke.
Oh, it was Brian Burke.
When he took over as a general manager. Now, Brian, I remember I talked to him once, and he said it was on the players' requests, that the players didn't want the college fight song, that it was too much, you know, too much of a college thing, and we're professionals now. But I haven't met, and there's Kevin Dineen as another one, I haven't met one ex-Hartford Whaler that didn't love the Brass Bonanza. Mm. And it's weird because, you know, Brian's a college guy too. It was a weird one.
Very weird one.
Oh, well.
Remember the whale, ladies and gentlemen. Remember
still, and listen, still, you know, some of the hottest selling merch at the NHL shop, always, still Hartford Whalers. Mm-hmm. They may not be a team, but their legacy lives on in hats and T-shirts and keychains. You have any Whalers gear?
Oh, I have a Whalers shirt. Didn't I wear a Whalers shirt to one of our parties?
Maybe. I don't know.
I have a Whalers shirt, and I'm in the market for a Whalers jersey. I just want to make sure I get the right one. I don't know what the right one is, by the way. I'll take suggestions.
You just talk to him.
I don't know.
Your new buddy. Your new buddy from Trade Deadline.
I am probably more inclined to get a Patty Verbeek one, to be quite honest.
Oh, the little ball of hate.
Yeah. For the obvious Devils connection, and also for the masochistic notion of getting a Verbeek jersey after that god awful trade. one last email, actually, this is for the question of the day, which is to describe the Vancouver Canucks in three words. This is Corrine Giesler. Three words: no thank you. Like having my aunt pass me a dish of creamed peas at American Thanksgiving. Ooh. I'll just pass that along and focus on my delicious mashed potatoes. Signed, Corrine Giesler, Chicago Blackhawks fan.
Just tough.
And remember, as much as there should be a level of sympathy for the good men on the Vancouver Canucks and the way that the team has been mismanaged into a tire fire and a dumpster fire, there are many franchises out there, one in Chicago, one in Boston, that is probably popping champagne as we speak about the utter disaster that is the Vancouver Canucks at this moment.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. But the thing is, it could get turned around if they make the right deal with Ryan Kesler. Like, I'm actually happy for that franchise. They didn't get rushed into making that deal at deadline.
But...
And they can take a longer view on the trade, because honestly, if they can hit a home run with that trade,
no,
it could help them out tons.
Dude, I wrote about this yesterday. The most chilling thing that left Ryan Kessler's mouth yesterday, or at the day of the deadline, was that he talked to Luongo, and Luongo said, "Don't worry, you're not going anywhere today." And he's right, because they waited 2 years. 2 years to find the quote-unquote right trade for Luongo. Now, granted, his contract, night and day from Kessler's, so we know that. Mm-hmm. But 2 years to find the right trade. So I don't buy the idea that just because that we should applaud Mike Gillis for being patient, because I don't buy the idea that Ryan Kessler is getting traded this summer.
I don't know that it's Mike Gillis that's going to be doing that deal.
Or the owners. I don't care. Gillis, owners, management, whoever. I don't buy the idea that someone is going to meet whatever astronomical price they have in mind for Kessler. And because Kessler is two things, a quiet dude
and a dude who plays his ass off no matter what the situation. One of the only Americans, mind you, that played in that bronze medal game was Ryan Kessler. Because of that, they will take advantage of it. And they know that no matter how long this thing goes, he's not going to turn tail and stop playing. He's not going to stop showing up to practice. Mm-hmm. He's going to be a good citizen. And that they're going to prey on that. And we're going to have to wait 2 years before he gets traded.
Nah, because Vancouver doesn't want to go through another Luongo. Trust me. Doesn't matter. You learn from your situation. They do not want to go through this again.
Doesn't matter.
They don't want to go through Luongo Part 2 with Ryan Kessler playing the role of the goaltender.
He's an asset, and you're right. The right deal could change this team around, and I think they'll just keep waiting for it. Keep waiting for that right deal.
I don't think so. I think they move him in the summer, if not at the draft.
Yo, you won't give us that top-level defenseman we're looking for? We can wait. He's a good guy. He'll play hard.
Well, we shall see, Greg. I think he gets moved in the summer.
All right. Well, this was an epic supersized edition of Merrick vs. Wyshynski. Thanks to Kevin Dineen, gold medal winning coach.
That was interesting. That was interesting talk about because everyone on Team Canada, all the blue liners shot left, and USADC used to dump it in the right corner and dine out. And just a simple little, because they flooded with two and then put the one on the wall, so the rim around wasn't going to work. They just dropped a center down and played middle of the ice. And we never saw it till the Olympics. Because, man, USA would pound on the Canadians. Just like hemmed in their own zone. That's a little sort of coaching nugget there for you. That was nice.
Thanks to Andy Thornton for joining us on Game Show Friday and doing so well. Thanks to everybody who chimed in with the three words about Vancouver. Congratulations to Tally and Katie for doing so well in their Game Show Friday.
Oh, yeah. You know what they get? Along. You know what they get? Nothing.
It's International Women's Day. Can you just be nice, please?
Oh.
It's bad enough that we opened the show with misogyny.
That was Maddie. We don't choose the intros.
I know it was.
It was Matt.
Maddie Hughes got his hands down his pants and is drinking a beer right now.
I think that was sexist,
wasn't
it?
Eating corn chips, burping at the television.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the glass, why are there women pilots? I don't have any confidence in them. It's like a woman can fly a plane. That's bullshit. Yeah. Maddie, why are you being so mean? You know why Dad made a Wonder Woman movie? Because no one wants to see it broad. That's why.
Wow.
Matt. Wow. How dare you? It's terrible.
Maddie's taking a beating today.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We will be back Monday.
Yeah, hey, nice to be back to a sort of relatively normal schedule.
Yep.
And I think I'm good for every day next week, too.
I think we've got a nice little stretch of days coming up in which we'll be doing this very podcast, and it's very exciting indeed. They don't have me covering the Paralympics.
They don't. I'm
just
doing...
just the Olympics.
I'm doing Hockey Central at noon all next week, so I'll be right here in the studio every day.
Oh, the great Darren Millard migration.
He's on VK.
Mm-hmm.
For a week.
Theo Fleury really thought it was a quiet day? Because... We've had some quiet days on deadlines.
Yeah, well,
sir.
That's
I didn't
just
think that was a
like,
quiet day.
Theo hasn't worked a whole ton of trade deadlines. I think that was the first trade deadline that he worked with us. And
right.
So, I mean, normally you get about what? How many trades were there? Because normally you get about 36, 37.
This was there were less trades, or sorry, fewer trades with more impact.
That's it. There were bigger names that went. There were bigger stories. Bigger sort of, oh my God, he got moved. Like, yeah, there was bigger that. There was less sort of, you know, your depth defenseman for this guy's depth forward. There wasn't the quality. There wasn't the quantity of it, but there was the quality.
Quality over quantity.
That's rare.
The opposite of this podcast.
Don't get that here. volume. Throw a lot out there. Fill
all right, everybody.
Airspace.
This weekend, by the way, check out the Mike Modano jersey retirement in Dallas on Saturday. I think Saturday or tonight. I forget.
I will tell you right now.
I believe it's Saturday.
Yeah, it's Saturday because they're not playing tonight.
The Wild?
Oh, really? Against the team against whom he should have just retired instead of going and doing that bullshit in Detroit, you mean?
That Marty almost did in Minnesota?
Oh, that's completely different.
little buddy, good to have you back. So easy to rile up.
So mad at Marty anyway. Doesn't matter. Go to Minnesota. Who cares? Jerk.
Now.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you on Monday. Bye.